Welcome to True Crime 101 with Murder Friends, the podcast where three friends from three different countries talk about murder. My name is Alana and I'm Canadian.
I'm Anna and I'm American.
My name's Hannah and I'm British.
In addition to our longer episodes, True Crime 101 talks you through key true crime cases and theories. I think I'm going to sneeze. Just give me a second.
You could take a picture of it and put it on your Instagram.
Oh my God, Hannah, before we start.
I watched that so many times.
So did I.
I saved it on a highlight on my profile because I'm obsessed with it.
Oh my God.
I'm ashamed to say how many times I watched it and then visibly laughed out loud.
Yeah,
sorry. It just made my day. I'm sorry.
It was perfect timing.
It was so good.
Okay. So this week we are going to talk about a guy I've never heard of and kind of wish I never heard of, but I found the crimes that he committed were not interesting, but also interesting, if that makes sense. And apparently, which I didn't know, Canada has a lot more serial killers than I first gave it credit for. And so today we are going to talk about another one, Gilbert Paul Jordan. And I would be shocked if either of you recognized that name, because I did not.
Nope, nothing.
So he was born in December of 1931. So, you know, we're going back a little bit. He is given the title the Boozing Barber. Not the flashiest name, but he was 100% an asshole murderer. So he was an alcoholic, high school dropout at the age of 16. By 1952, he already had a criminal record, which included theft, assault, and heroin possession. So an interesting man. Hmm. And just awful, awful. Now, how do I want to start this? Okay. Canada's worst crime and an ongoing crime is the continuous systematic racism and abuse against natives. I don't know how many people are familiar with the whole, you know, ever-changing, always ongoing story, and I really need to do it for a True Crime 101, but it kind of freaks me out because it is such a big story and I'm terrified of doing it wrong. But that sort of history and mindset is really important to why this awful man got away with what he did for so long. So the Coles Notes version of this whole awful, awful thing, Canada, both Canadians, like white Canadians, and the government do not give a shit about natives. And it's something that still happens now. So even though the story, you know, is sort of in the 50s and 60s, it's still something that we are dealing with today. And basically, natives get the absolute worst rap. And we have these things called residential schools, which natives were rounded up and put into. Every and any type of abuse you can think of, they suffered at these schools. And so we're talking like generational trauma. People are scarred. There is a lot of alcoholism and mental illness and suicides as a result of that. Even to this day, you know, the generational trauma that's come down. Anyway, Jordan used this as his MO in a way that he could kill Aboriginal women and nobody really cared. But the way that he did it is fucking strange. Anyway, okay. We believe that Jordan began killing in 1965, but there's a lot unknown in this case, particularly because his victims were Aboriginal women in Vancouver's downtown east side, and people didn't really care about them, so there's not a lot of news articles or reports or arrests or that kind of stuff. So some of the stuff is a little bit fuzzy. But typically, he would find these women in bars and buy them drinks, or encourage them to drink with him, or try to pay them to have sex with him. At some point, they would pass out, and he would continue to pour alcohol down their throats. Ooh. Which I didn't even think was a thing. This, of course, would result in deaths that were reported as alcohol poisoning. And because police paid little attention, because a lot of statistically, there are natives that deal with alcoholism at a higher percentage than other groups, again, because there's so much trauma that's in the background. So a lot of the police would say, oh, you know, it's just another native. It's just another alcoholic. you know, they've done this to themselves. Although the newspapers often described the women as sex workers, not all of them were involved in sex work, but because they said it, that was like the narrative that stuck. So you think native, sex workers, alcoholics, who cares? And Jordan was able to go on attacking these women. Now, Jordan himself was known for drinking more than 50 ounces of vodka every day, which just makes your stomach kind of turn.
How much is that in?
I know. I don't know.
Well, if you think that... a typical drink, you do like 1 or 2 ounces. So he's doing 50 ounces.
Ugh. So it's like 50 normal drinks a day, essentially.
Yeah, a vodka. Straight. Obviously, like he's not mixing it with anything nice.
He's just, yeah, just straight up.
He's just sitting there making screwdrivers. Yeah.
Screwdrivers, sorry. Jesus.
Sorry.
So because he had such a ridiculous tolerance, he could very easily outdrink any of his victims. They would pass out. He would force alcohol down their throats. They would subsequently die. The death would be rural alcohol poisoning, and he just kind of carried on.
So that's literally how he would kill them, is by putting alcohol down their throats. And like, wow. I don't think I've ever heard.
Yeah, it's bizarre.
Strange.
Yeah, it's pretty messed up. So the first woman known to have died by alcohol poisoning while in Jordan's company was in 1965. So as it would have become a pattern, she was a switchboard operator named Ivy Rose. Wicked cool name. Mm. Unfortunately for Ivy Rose, she was found naked and dead in a Vancouver hotel. Her blood alcohol level was about 0.51. So they found her. They thought, wow, she drank herself to death, so no charges were laid. As far as we know, Jordan is the first Canadian to use alcohol as a murder weapon, which is actually why I ended up choosing this story. I'd never heard of any sort of attack in that way. So eventually we do get to a trial. So we do find court proceedings, and court evidence show that he sought out approximately 200 women per year for binge drinking episodes, covering the period from 1980 to 1988. He was also typically looking for sex as well, as you do. Of course, this is only looking at 8 years within the 80s. So we don't even know the numbers from the 60s or the 70s. Like, this was his whole life, really, was seeking out these women.
Oh my God.
Further, we also have the Crown provided evidence that Jordan was linked to deaths of 6 other Aboriginal women. Similar fact evidence showed Jordan had been with the women at the time of their deaths. So it's kind of like it's hard to say that he caused it, because they were drinking and they were drinking with him. And so to find like that actual link, like to have someone watch him pour it down their throat sort of thing, was quite difficult. But we have, in terms of women who did die in his presence, we have Mary Johnson in 1980, Barbara Paul in 1981, Mary Johns, 1982, Patricia Thomas, 1984, Patricia Andrew, 1985, and Vera Harry, 1986. All of them had huge levels of blood alcohol, obviously. Like, they were drinking. And of course, he continued to force them to drink after they've passed out. Some of them even died in his barbershop, or were seen drinking in his barbershop and then later died. Hence the name, the, you know, boozing barber, which is just awful. Now, in 87, we finally get some level of investigation. Vanessa Lee Buckner was found naked at the Niagara Hotel after a night of drinking with Jordan. Now, there's some debate regarding Vanessa. Some sources indicate that she was a white woman. She wasn't a heavy drinker, nor was she a sex worker. And maybe we can assume that this is why this particular case started the investigation. You know, she's a white woman. Official court documents describe Buckner's death as the result of Jordan supplying a lethal amount of liquor to a female alcoholic who died as a result. So that's what they went after him for. Buckner had recently lost custody of her newborn baby, who had been born with a drug dependency. She was an alcoholic. She had issues with drugs. And Jordan basically said, you know, I can give you what you want kind of thing, and killed her. Just a month after her death, another woman, Edna Shade, was found dead in a nearby hotel in the same manner. So I don't know if he'd been doing this for so long and just thought, nobody's catching on, so I'm literally going to do the same exact thing a month later at a nearby hotel. Or maybe the vodka was finally getting to his brain. I don't know. After being questioned, Jordan, while not charged with any crime related to Buckner's death, so that was the original woman, Vanessa, but police started surveillance on him because it didn't quite add up. So between October and November of 87, police watched him, and he still searched out Aboriginal women in this sort of rougher area of Vancouver. On four different occasions, the police actually intervened when he was with a woman before she could become a victim, if you can believe it.
Oh my God.
So we have four women who were with him, who were heavily intoxicated. The police intervene. I guess at that point, like, they don't charge him, but they separate them, basically, because they're worried that something could happen. Now, finally, in 1988, we get that trial, and Jordan is tried before a judge alone. He's finally found guilty, although only of manslaughter, in the death of Buckner. So that was that white woman a couple years prior. He was sentenced to 15 years in prison, but was reduced to 9 years on appeal because, of course, Jordan only served 6 years for that manslaughter conviction. After his release, he was placed on probation, which restricted him to Vancouver Island. But naturally, at this point, he's just going to keep going, right? I mean, he's got away with so much. So at this point, we're in June 2000. He's charged with sexual assault, negligence causing bodily harm, administering a noxious substance, alcohol. In that same year, he tried to change his name, but because a name change in British Columbia requires fingerprinting and a criminal check, he wasn't able to. So he drops his application. He's trying to just sort of like fade away into obscurity, but isn't quite able to. And again, 2 years later, 2002, he's arrested for a breach of probation because he's found drinking and in the presence of a woman who was also drinking, which was a big no-go. He was found guilty and sentenced to 15 months, followed by 3 years probation, strict conditions that he can't be, you know, with women, with alcohol, that kind of stuff. Of course, why would he stop? Because that would be too easy. So now we're in 2004. Jordan is 72, by the way. He's an old dude. He's arrested in Winnipeg for violating that probation order at a hotel. So he had been identified as he was binge drinking with this woman, Barb Buckley. Buckley was a long-term resident at the hotel and had a serious drinking problem. She was taken to the hospital by a friend and a hotel employee, Kathy Waddington. After finding Buckley in a really bad state, they took her to the hospital, got her sorted. But Waddington identified Jordan as being there. But that wasn't enough because he was acquitted of those charges. Basically, we're up to 2005. They release a warning to the public, the police department, basically saying, you know, we've got this guy, Gilbert Paul Jordan. At this point, he's 73. You know, they give his age, his height, weight. He is partially bald with gray hair and a gray goatee. Essentially, the warning was just that he has a significant criminal record, including manslaughter and indecent assault. He uses alcohol to lure victims, which I still think is such a fucking creepy choice. It also says he's subject to court-ordered conditions, including abstaining completely from alcohol. He shouldn't be in the company of a person where alcohol is being consumed. If you observe him, like, call the police, yada, yada, yada. But again, he's basically kind of like in and out of prison. He doesn't really do anything lengthy, which is shockingly upsetting. But just after 2 more years in and out of jail, only for parole violations, because he just can't stop. The boozing barber finally dies in 2006 at 74 in Victoria, British Columbia. So one can assume, based on his known actions, that he did this his whole life, really, and died at 74. So the fact you got like a good chunk of decades where he is drinking people to death. And really, I mean, he got away with it. He only did a couple years in prison, in and out, nothing substantial. And yet we know for sure that 6 women at least died in his presence after drinking. But, I mean, he got away with it.
That's insane.
There must have been so many more.
Oh, probably like hundreds.
Yeah.
Like 100 or something.
Well, they did say that, I don't know where they got the number, but that he sought out approximately 200 women per year for these particularly 8 years in the 80s. So 200 women per year. So we're talking like almost every day, really. Having a couple days off and then going back at it again.
That's crazy. It's just like, I mean, I guess it was like a crime. In a way, it's quite genius in a way, really. Because you can't prove it. It's like really hard to prove, right? Unless you literally catch him doing it. How do you prove that? That they didn't just do it themselves, right?
Yeah.
And I think too, because he targeted women who may have already had problems with alcohol, and of course, like Native women who basically don't count to the police at all. Unless, like you said, unless someone saw him like pouring it down their throat, it would be so hard to prove that he caused the death. Because really, they chose to drink, as far as we know. They chose to drink and hang out with him. So really, it's alcohol poisoning on the face of it. But the fact that he was sneaky enough to cause it himself, I just thought was bananas.
Do you think his problem with alcohol, because he obviously had a huge alcohol problem himself, drinking that much vodka per day is going to do you some like serious internal damage. Do you think that he thought that if he could handle it, someone else could handle it? Because we've all been out with people who have been like, oh, just have another drink, and it's like, I will literally die if I drink more.
Are you looking at me? The tequila shots, I think, oh my God, here it is. Here's the end.
I was like,
I don't want to
hey
name
now.
Any names, but like, it makes you wonder like what his mental state was and whether he lost any inhibition when he was drinking with them, that he thought it would be funny or he thought it would be fine to then take that course of action.
Mm.
I wonder if there's any like diminished responsibility.
That's a good point.
Mm. Or like, did he actually set out to kill them? Was he like a serial killer? Or like, what was he doing?
They name him as a serial killer because obviously there's more than, I think, 2 or 3 victims gives you serial killer status.
Yeah, spread out, isn't it? Yeah.
But you think if he was an alcoholic young enough, what that does to your brain, right? And then to just continue it throughout your entire life. Like, I can only imagine what his insides must have been like by the end of it.
Probably perfectly preserved.
Yeah. Pickled.
Just slightly pickled. Slightly shrunk, yeah. Oh, that's disgusting.
Yeah, so that is the story of Gilbert Paul Jordan and the act of using alcohol as a murder weapon.
That's insane. What is really good. There's... Is it like the Lost Highway or something? There's a...
Yeah.
What is the one that they do a lot on?
Highway of Tears.
Highway of Tears.
Yeah.
Yes. That's in Canada, right?
Yeah. So that is, again, out west. So this was taking place primarily in British Columbia and Vancouver's downtown east side, which a lot of people refer to as like Vancouver's Skid Row sort of place. But out west in British Columbia sort of way. I'm not sure if it's in Alberta as well, but there is the Highway of Tears where there is a shocking amount of people who have disappeared, mostly women, and I think a very high percentage are Native as well, and they are just literally disappeared off the face of the earth, completely gone. No evidence, nothing. And that in itself is another True Crime 101 that I need to do, but it's so scary because it is so huge.
You could do it as a two-parter.
That is a big one.
Maybe.
It's a big undertaking, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. I know some of them are a little bit, big cases like that are like, yeah, they're a bit frightening to do because you're like, oh, what if I just don't get it right or if I don't tell it well? Or some stories, like, I think even some of the ones that I know that I've tried to tell, you're like, am I doing this justice? Am I saying, you know, like, I'm not case file. Like, I haven't done weeks of research. Like, you know what I mean? Like, but you just give your best shot. It's not me, guys. I'm not an Australian man. No. sorry, spoiler alert. I know what you mean, though, that some of them, even though you want to, yeah, it's like really they're just like feel like a lot.
Well, it's the same with like the residential schools are such a, it's such a huge story that has impacted so many people. And I don't know how many people actually realize that this happened. And we're talking like fairly recently. The only like the, you know, the last few schools closed down within the last sort of few generations. It's not like a ancient history kind of thing. It's pretty recent and it's horrific. So I don't really know how many people actually know like what Canada did, but also I'm terrified to talk about it because I don't want to do it poorly because it is such a horrific. We still see evidence of it today. You know, we still have native reserves in Canada. Obviously not all natives live on reserves, but we do have them and we do have communities. And I mean, these reserves don't always have clean water or electricity or proper access to healthcare or schools or all that kind of thing. Like that's happening right now. So that does, I think, play a huge part in Jordan's story because he targeted these people. I mean, same with, Picton, the pig farmer guy. He targeted, you know, sex workers and homeless people, you know, the ones that sort of slipped through the cracks. But
it does highlight those, like, biases that police have, though, doesn't it? That you think maybe if they had paid a little bit more attention to the women that were dying, regardless of their, like, skin color or where they were from, perhaps he wouldn't have been able to get away with it for so long. It's negligence by the police at the end of the day, I just might.
Yeah, 100%. I do think because he used alcohol, like, as much as he's, like, a terrible person, that it's such a clever way of doing it.
That's what
and
I meant.
I don't know if anybody out there, if anybody listening has a story in your country where you know someone has used alcohol as a murder weapon, I would be very interested to hear because I had never heard of it. And it certainly is incredibly difficult to prove.
Yeah, if you just replaced alcohol with, like, he stabbed women, like, obviously he never would have gotten, I mean, I would imagine he still even, he would never have gotten that far or gone on that long, you would imagine. Or he would have been in jail a whole lot longer. But, yeah, that's crazy. I've never heard of, that's a very interesting one, actually. That was good because never heard of anything like that.
Yeah, it's brilliant. The storytelling, not the person.
Yeah. Well, that's all we have for today. You can check out our website at murderfriends.com where you can find Alana's sources for today's episode. You can email us at murderfriendspod@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter at murderfriendspd and Instagram at murderfriendspod. And we will see you next time.
Bye.